Welcome to Canadian Defense Focus from CDR Radio, produced by Canadian Defense Review Magazine. This series of podcasts features interviews with leaders and experts in the defense industry, as well as reports and profiles on the very latest in defense technology.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Canadian Defense Focus. I'm James Careless, Ottawa Bureau Chief with Canadian Defense Review, Canada's leading defense magazine. This time on Canadian Defense Focus, we're speaking with Simon Carroll, the newly appointed president of PAL Aerospace. He is here today to talk about his new role with the company and how PAL Aerospace is well-placed to build Canada's sovereign defense capability. Simon, thanks for joining us here today.
No problems.
So please tell us about yourself, your career, and PAL Aerospace.
Well, I could say how long do we have, so I'll give you the modified version. I'm a former Australian naval officer, so a Navy guy in the aerospace industry is something that we're still all wrapping our heads around a little bit. But I was in the Australian Navy for 13 years. I was an air warfare officer. I loved my career there. Got an opportunity to join the defence industry in Australia. And I did 18 months working for a company where I pretty much just did consulting. And then I joined CEA Technologies, which shouldn't be confused with CAE, working as a sales manager there for an Australian-owned and Australian-based company doing sales for active phased array radars and continuous wave solid-state illuminators. So very radar and transmitter heavy, which is really what the background that I had in the Navy was as an air warfare officer as well. From there, I did a lot of work with Saab. There was a big contract in Australia, the Anzac Class Anti-Ship Missile Defence Upgrade Program, and the two companies were tied at the hip to deliver that to the Australian government. Met a lot of good people at Saab in Australia, and it was through there one of them gave me an opportunity to join Saab, but in the Middle East. So I've never actually worked for Saab in Australia. I went and joined Saab in the Middle East in 2013 and sort of went on a two-year plan, and now it's 2026 and we haven't been home since. Well, we've been home to visit, but that's about it. My work at Saab in the Middle East was initially as a vice president of sales and marketing, with the focus on Bahrain and Algeria. And from there, I took over as the general manager and president of Saab Middle East in 2015 and was responsible for all the operations, but really the business development and sales and marketing for all of the Middle East minus Saudi Arabia, because that had its own operational setup. But I also was responsible for Pakistan as part of that as well. So a really eye-opening experience, both from a personal and a professional perspective, learning about a totally different culture to what we have or had in Australia at the time, and an experience that I think has really taught me a lot about doing business, particularly from an international perspective, and really appreciating the understanding of, forming long-term relationships and forming relationships where both partners of equal benefit. It was probably there that I got out of the mindset that I needed a customer contractor type relationship or a customer contractor setup. It was important to make it less formal to get the business and to do the business. Obviously, you'll always have your contracts that you have to live and breathe by, but working with particularly the different types of Arab cultures in, because they're all slightly different in the Middle East, really taught me about the importance of relationships and partnerships rather than just contracts. And so that was a real eye-opener, but one that Saab very gratefully afforded me. And so the opportunity from there, from a family perspective, meant that we were ready to move on after 5 years. And again, got the opportunity to come to Canada after that. So since 2018, I've been the president of Saab Canada until March this year, when I joined PAL Aerospace as the president of that organisation. Been very, very lucky in my career to have some really good people not only support me but help guide me. So I had some really good mentors at some really senior positions in the companies that I appreciate not everybody got. So I'm, you know, as I said, very fortunate both at a personal and professional perspective, and have been able to take advantage of that. You know, you take advantage of the situations and the opportunities that you're given. And I think that's what's been able to happen with myself. And I've learned a lot along the way and taken a lot from a lot of people. But I'd also like to think that I've, over time, have given back to people as part of my team and part of other teams. So look, really, I've, as I said, been very lucky, but I've had a really enjoyable career. Every time I've moved a job, it's been at my calling. I've, you know, some places not gone looking for jobs, they've come looking for me, which is a fantastic position to be in. And as I've said, just been very lucky. And you make your own luck in some occasions, but I think, you know, I've been very fortunate, put it that way.
So why did you decide to join PAL Aerospace, especially at the time when the defense industrial strategy is kicking in? What attracted you to the company?
When I was going through the process to join PAL, I was asking, you know, a lot of trusted people, you know, because you don't spread it too far and wide when you're looking, you know, what they knew about the company. And virtually every single one of them looked at me and said, oh, good people. You know, so the people is a big part of what I go to a job for, because, you know, you're going to spend so much of your time with these people that it's always better to be able to get along with people. And, you know, I find that if you can work with an organisation, with the people in that organisation, at a friendly, happy environment and a, you know, type of level, then it makes the business that much easier, because it's easier to get everyone on the same page. It's easier to get everyone to enjoy what they're doing. And I find that if people enjoy what they're doing and like the people they're working with, then the end product, the actual business side of it, is a lot more beneficial as well. From a business perspective, what I really liked about PAL was that they're a Canadian company. I mentioned CEA earlier. I loved working for an Australian company that sold Australian product to the international market. Saab was a company that was obviously international to Canada, being based in Sweden. So I was working for what I would call an international company selling specifically to Canada. And PAL gave me that opportunity to be now part of an Canadian company again, working for, you know, selling and working on an international level again. And, you know, being able to do that now at the level that I was, you know, being offered the position, was one that was super attractive. The company itself is one that I saw was going, you know, had gone through some changes with regards to being purchased by EIC, but being a big part of Exchange Income Corporation and then being able to be part of a Canada-wide operation like EIC was one that, you know, certainly came with opportunities that was really attractive to me as well. So, yeah, people is always a big one for me. The domestic side of it being, you know, now that I'm Canadian as well as Australian, the opportunity to represent a Canadian company on the international stage was really quite attractive. And then, you know, working with a company like PAL that I could see had taken, you know, significant steps and growth, and then, you know, bringing my experiences to that to help the company grow to the next level was something that was, you know, really attractive to me as well. So it was probably some of the softer side of the business that drew me to it more than anything else, rather than, you know, the hardware side of it and the real contract side of it. But as I said, you know, you get that softer side of it sorted out, people, relationships, domestic capabilities, and I think that part of it that leads to the contracts and the business and the operations falls into place a little more naturally from my experience.
Now, why should Canada move from simply buying capability to building and scaling Canadian-owned mission capability?
I think if you look at what's happening around the world today, and obviously the scale-up of defence spending globally, it's natural for countries to start looking after their own base. And then when you consider what the Prime Minister has said pretty much right from the start with regards to his plans for defence, his plans for defence spending, you look at his speech at Davos, you look at other examples of, you know, what he said when he addressed the Parliament in Australia as well. And he's put a very clear a very clear sign to Canada and to the Canadian defence industry that buying and building and maintaining a capability here in Canada is of the utmost importance. I mean, we could, you know, have a whole separate discussion around the importance of doing that based on the change in status of the relationship between Canada and the US at the moment. But I think if we stick to the premise of your question, you know, countries really need to have a high level or a certain level of self-reliance, regardless of the relationships that they have on a political and an international level. And I think Canada was, you know, probably by its own self-admission, a little behind in that regard when it comes to defence in particular. Very strong in some other areas around social topics and social issues in particular. But from a defence perspective, sort of a little bit behind in the background. And that was sort of evident to me, I should say, when I first came to Canada and looked at, you know, what the priority of the Canadian defence portfolio was compared to some of the other portfolios. Now, finance, transport, health, education are always going to be up there. But in my previous roles and my previous sort of, locations in Australia and the Middle East, defence was considered up there with those. And in Canada, it wasn't that. And this is an opportunity to bring Canada up to that. And I think increasing the sovereignty and the importance of the Canadian defence industry, along with a political level of self-reliance that Canada should have when it comes to defending itself on the global market, I think, you know, really brings us into why it's so important, I should say. The Defence Industrial Strategy certainly outlines that, and I see that as a really positive step. And, you know, the build, partner, buy perspective is one that I think is a really good one to follow. And I'm also one of those rare beasts, I think, in the industry that actually doesn't mind the idea of the ITB policy either. I think it makes a lot of sense, particularly when you're talking about spending the amount of money that Canada is looking to spend. I do, however, think that there's better ways that we can execute that program. And to be fair, the team at ISED and those within the ITB branch seem to be listening and certainly willing to engage in conversation. I've had lots of discussions with the team there at different levels, and, you know, it is a conversation, which is great. It's not a tell us what you think and then we'll go away and implement something else. I think there's a real willingness to work together, which is a real positive.
In your view, what does achieving Arctic sovereignty actually require when it comes to persistence, presence, domain awareness, logistics, SAR, and rapid response?
All of the above. You know, I don't think you can achieve Arctic sovereignty without a measure of all of those things that you've just mentioned. I mean, presence is key, and the government's made, you know, several announcements about activities in reinforcing bases and facilities and infrastructure in the north that will be extremely important to doing that. But that presence can come in many different ways, whether it's boots on the ground, whether it's support to our Indigenous communities in the north so that they have an understanding of the role that is important for them to play in that piece as well, whether it's more aircraft surveilling the north, the Arctic offshore patrol vessels continuing their patrols up there, submarines potentially in the future being part of that as well. I think it's all a part of it. I mean, I'm still very much learning about the enormity of Canada's Arctic, you know, region in particular. I mean, it still blows my mind when you consider that just the distances that need to be covered to get not only assets up there, but the infrastructure and the logistics support that's needed to get fuel and food and the like. And through some of the very early activities that I've been fortunate enough to be involved in with, you know, PAL's sister companies at EIC, like Perimeter and Canadian North, and looking at what they're doing when it comes to, you know, supporting those northern communities and flying people backwards and forwards to those communities and the cargo that they take, you know, everything from wheels and pop to diapers and all sorts of things, that sort of logistic element to it, you know, that obviously extends to pretty much all elements of what needs to be done to achieve Arctic sovereignty. Because, as I said, if Arctic sovereignty is achieved through presence, the only way that that presence is sustained is through a massive logistical support arm that enables people to be there, aircraft to fly there, ships and submarines to operate there as well. So, you know, it's a huge operation, and one that I think the more you look into it, the more you realise just how massive that is. But strategically, it's obviously, you know, extremely important. The Arctic is a bit of a forgotten, you know, I guess in the past, a bit of a forgotten area, because the environmental conditions have, you know, been working really against any form of real full-scale threat from approaching Canada from that area. But when you throw in advances in technology, climate change, the ability to operate in the Arctic is becoming, I think, more and more realistic. And therefore, the you know, the approach now to be in the Arctic and to, you know, be present there, put resources there, put capabilities there, is really the only way for the Canadian government to approach what the potential is for threats in the future.
Now, PAL Aerospace is known for having a wide range of proven capabilities under one roof, from mission software and aircraft modification to special mission operations, sustainment and training. Can you walk us through those capabilities and what makes them truly Canadian?
Well, the capabilities are something that I'm still learning about. You know, I've been there for 2.5 months, and I couldn't tell you the number of people that I said to at CANSEC over the last couple of days that I'm still drinking from a fire hose when it comes to PAL's capabilities. Because you're right, they are a bit of a one-stop shop when it comes to the things you mentioned. I'll answer the second part of your question first, and then I'll come back. What makes them truly Canadian? It's all done here in Canada by Canadians. The headquarters and a large portion of the team is in St. John's in Newfoundland. And I'm spending a lot of time there over the, you know, the first couple of months of being with the company, and see the importance of spending more time there in the future. But it's a great team, a great group of people that are really keen on just delivering for the company and making sure that the company can meet its requirements under the contracts that we have. And then on top of that, we've got teams in, you know, building teams now in Winnipeg. We've got people on Air Force bases out west, in Halifax at Greenwood, near Halifax at Greenwood. We've got a larger office in Halifax with the CartNav team that we've got there, and some of our air operations activities there. We've got more people in Vaughan outside of Toronto. We've got an engineering arm that used to be Decker Aviation and is now, you know, part of the PAL engineering team as well. So really across the country, we've got people in a whole heap of different locations. And the contracts that we're executing for the Canadian government are showing that we need to do more of that. You know, we're putting more people in more bases. You know, the fixed wing SAR program that we're working, you know, as a partner with Airbus, is getting different people across the different bases. And we're hoping to get the team in Winnipeg fully set up there shortly. Completing that setup there shortly, and then we're going to move on to doing the same again in Trenton. So what makes it Canadian is the fact that we've got all these Canadians doing the work in Canada and supporting the operations that we're doing internationally as well. And that's the exciting part of it for me, taking this Canadian expertise with our Canadian teams and, you know, taking that internationally. And then building international organisations like the team that we're building in the Netherlands and the UK, for example, at the moment, complementing it with Canadians initially, and then, you know, ideally bringing those Canadians home and letting, you know, a Dutch team and a British team get in and execute those programs as we build partnership and grow over there. So that's the what makes it Canadian piece. The first part of your question around the wide range of proven capabilities, you know, when you've got a team that can build up mission critical software like the CartNav team, and they can put that into other PAL capabilities like a modification of an aircraft, an upgrade of an aircraft mission system, or they can take it separately somewhere else. Gives us a lot of flexibility around that, you know, software design and development piece. Our engineering team in Vaughan can work, again, internally within PAL's operations. But then, likewise, they've got capabilities where they can, you know, sell an engineering modification or work with another team of another airline to create an engineering modification for their aircraft. So, again, it's almost like it's a different business line, but one that also helps us internally. And then, of course, you've got the aircraft modification piece that we do predominantly at our facilities and the hangars in St. John's. The team there have been modifying aircraft for, you know, many years now, decades in fact, and doing a great job of, again, working with other engineering facilities to work out how to do the modifications. In some cases we work with, some cases we do it on our own. You look at the aircraft that we've modified for the UK Home Office contract that we've been executing for the last couple of years. Fantastic capability that is being used on a daily basis to look at, you know, the struggle that the UK are having against illegal immigration and, you know, people coming across the English Channel, and that's working with that all the time. So that capability is fantastic. And then you know, it's not just about the development of the capability, it's then about using the capability to execute and run the operations that we have. So, you know, we've been flying for the Department of Fisheries, well, what was the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, but the Department of Fisheries now for, you know, I think since the 80s, if I remember my notes correctly. So flying for Canadian government for that purpose, flying for, you know, the energy sector, offshore oil and gas facilities, you know, making sure that, you know, icebergs are not going to come down from the Arctic and create all sorts of damage to those facilities, which would, of course, cause a massive environmental or having a massive environmental impact if they were to be damaged significantly. So, you know, there's a real wide range of that civil security piece and public safety piece that I hadn't really, I think, clued in on too much before I joined the company that I'm really starting to appreciate. Obviously, my background has been defence since I left high school, so that side of it came to me a lot more easily, I guess. But looking into the civil security and public safety side of it, you know, the company does and has been doing for a long time some really amazing things that are opening my eyes the more I learn about it.
Now, you mentioned CANSEC. What did you do at the show? What did you bring out to the floor to introduce to the delegates?
Yeah, sure. So it's hard to exhibit aircraft modification. So, you know, but we had a couple of models at the show of, you know, I mentioned the UK Home Office platform. You know, we were there with that. The fixed wing search and rescue platform, the C-295, the Airbus aircraft that we've been working, as I said before, in partnership with Airbus. So we had those sorts of physical models on the floor that we could talk to people about. But the big thing that we were really talking to, you know, the key stakeholders in the Canadian government about was the current proposal that we've put forward around what we would call Northern Surveillance. And that's an opportunity where we've mentioned to the government what we'd like to do is run what we call a COCO type operation, so contractor owned, contractor operated, where we would look to modify and base four Dash 8 Q400 aircraft in the northern areas in Canada. So Goose Bay, Iqaluit and Inuvut have aircraft based at those areas, and run a really flexible capability. And I say flexible because it's really multifaceted. So there's the obvious surveillance piece. Northern Surveillance sort of tells the story there. So kitting an aircraft with, you know, sensors and capabilities that would enable an extensive surveillance activity to be able to take place across the north. But also have a platform that is, you know, specific to that area and can really operate up there. So, you know, gravel and snow rated from a landing perspective when you don't have the runways that you might need for other aircraft. Have a capability that not only would have the surveillance capability where you'd have operators, you know, with monitors and the like and the full capability to operate those, but then still have 20 seats available from a transport perspective, whether that transport is transporting troops up into the northern areas, transporting people back into the communities, transporting government officials up there for visits, whatever that might be, having a facility where you have an extra, you know, fuel capacity, and you could use that capacity to extend the surveillance hours of the aircraft while it's doing a surveillance mission, or you could have it so that you are going and delivering fuel to the northern community. So I think there's about 20,000 odd litres of spare fuel that we could deliver to those northern communities as part of that trip as well. And then, of course, having all the mission, you know, equipment and the like, and cargo and storage down the back as well, to then be able to take things with you to those northern regions. So that was something that we were very keen to make sure that we'd get out there, so that the message was there, because when you start educating and advising, you know, key Canadian government stakeholders of not only the capabilities of PAL, but the capabilities of EIC and our sister companies, and the one I'll mention here is, you know, Canadian North. They have a massive infrastructure in the north. So when it comes to infrastructure, we wouldn't need anything additional to be put in place for our proposed solution or a proposed offer for northern surveillance. We can operate with what the EIC family of companies already has in the region. We're willing from an EIC level to invest our own money into that capability as well. And so the government really has a solution, a ready-made solution, where they get surveillance opportunities, transport, cargo, additional fuel, and that capability into the north with a sister group of companies that can not only work together to provide the infrastructure that is needed to support that type of operation, but do it at very low cost to the government. You know, there is obviously the business side of it. You know, we would be selling the services associated with it. But, you know, I was listening to a few of our other senior executives speak this week, and it's, you know, if we don't fly the service, then the government doesn't pay for it. So it's one that I think we can do quite quickly. I would hope the procurement system would be flexible enough to allow a quick transition to that type of capability becoming available as well. But, you know, it's something that is very fitting of what we're after at the time. You know, we talked about Arctic sovereignty already. You've talked about, you know, the defence industrial strategy and how we want to get capabilities to the end users quicker. This is a way of being able to do that. But it also takes into consideration the fact that, you know, you look at the amount of capability the Air Force is introducing at the moment as well. The Air Force only has so many people to introduce all these new capabilities at the same time. So this is an opportunity where we wouldn't be a draw on the Air Force manpower, because we've got the pilots to fly the planes, we've got the ground crew who can help operate the planes, and on top of that, we would look to engage the Indigenous communities and expand, you know, their support of, you know, the maintenance and the ground crew activity of those aircraft in the northern regions as well. So in my view, and it's, granted, it's a little bit biased, but it's a real win-win-win across the board for the government, the Indigenous communities, and for PAL.
So what could the Canadian government do differently to make our procurement process work better? For example, how could we benefit from engaging Canadian industry earlier, scaling proven domestic capability faster, or treating IP and operational know-how as strategic assets?
I think that's a question that's sort of keep being asked for the last, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5 years. I think for the most part, the government and your organisations like your PSPCs and your D&Ds and your ISEDs are taking really good steps and really positive steps forward in the right direction to deal with this. Obviously, the setup of the Defence Investment Agency, I think, is a good step in the right direction to have a specific defence arm that looks after procurement for the defence and defence industry. The Defence Industrial Strategy is a great step in the right direction as well, providing guidance on what the government is after for from industry. But I think it's, you know, we've now got to take it to the next level with regards to those early engagements with industry and, you know, being clear and treating it like, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, a partnership. It, you know, to do this really effectively, we can't be seen as the government, you know, is the contractor and industry. Well, sorry, the government as the customer and the industry as the seller, so to speak. If you keep doing that, it keeps becoming so transactional that you never get out of that cycle, and it becomes then about what are the terms of the contract, and you follow those to the letter of the law, and it becomes very black and white as to where the line is and where the line isn't. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not naive enough to think that contracts are not in place for a very good reason, and of course we need that to take place, but if you can have a genuine relationship and a genuine partnership going into the development and the signing of those contracts, the execution of those contracts, in my mind, becomes a whole lot easier. I've been fortunate to see it happen in Canada at a really solid working level when I was with Saab for the urgent operational requirement for the Soldier Portable Air Defence System program. The work that the Army and the PSPC team did around that in particular was, you know, for me, a real positive example and almost like the blueprint of how we can run those programs. The relationship from the first kickoff meeting was fantastic. Everything was about how do we do this together to get the capability to the warfighter as soon as humanly possible while executing it within the bounds of what the contract looked like. Now, granted, it's an urgent operational requirement, so there's a little bit of extra flexibility there, but in many ways, there's not extra flexibility in the way that the PSP process is you know, sort of formulated and what it looked like. It just happened faster. And I think we need to actually try and bring that forward and bring that mentality to all the programs that we operate. I mean, you'll have heard industry say, you know, over and over again, we need to get the money spent and we need to do things faster. There's a bit of an element of that being on industry, of educating the government stakeholders as to how that can happen. And there's a bit, I think, on the government side of being willing to move to different contracting, or I won't say contracting mechanisms, but different approaches to existing contracting mechanisms to expedite the process. I do have a concern that the DIA will almost be forced to adopt quite a lot of that. And I've spoken quite extensively with Secretary of State Furr, and I know what he sees and wants to do. But then I've also heard others say the different procurement acts and things will prevent that from happening, and we've got to go through this step and this step and this step. I really hope the government finds ways around that, because in lots of cases there's opportunities where, you know, an early signal to industry to be able to get on and do something and then really let them get on and do it, rather than cover it in red tape and make sure it's, you know, the contract is so specific that it slows the opportunities to advance forward. You know, I really hope they find ways to try and, you know, do that at a more pragmatic type of level. I'm a big proponent of my mantra at the moment, which is progression is better than perfection. You know, we're in a situation now where we need to move forward and we need to get money spent and we need to get contracts executed and we need to get capabilities delivered, all, you know, in a much faster, faster way of doing it. And to me, the best way to do that is not to focus on the golden 100% solution right from the get-go. Technology is changing so fast that if you sign a contract today, by the time you deliver it, the, you know, what you've signed up for has been superseded. I think everybody knows that. I think a way that we can approach that is, you know, if we get an 80% solution that is, you know, is going to be close enough and deliver a fantastic capability, then let's move on that and work forward from there. And then when you get to the delivery stage and as you get closer to that initial operating capability that we all want to get to, look at what that other 20% looks like then. I mean, the chief of the commander of the Navy right now and soon to be vice chief of the defence staff, Admiral Topshey, I really like his approach to it, where it's let's just get stuff moving, and then through the, you know, the programs like continuous capability sustainment, we'll catch up in the future. We'll look at what comes next, and we'll look at what gets that. And in some ways, if we ever get to the 100% capability that is in the requirements, then maybe we haven't developed the requirements well enough as we've gone along and as the technology's changed. Because, you know, if we're doing continuous capability sustainment properly, we're really ruling out these large block upgrades that have happened in the past and have been, you know, ones that have said, right, at this stage, we're going to add, you know, an extra 40% capability. We should be adding 5% capability in 8 different gaps to get to that stage over time to keep our Canadian forces and the technology and the equipment and systems that they use more relevant as the technology moves on rather than as a program comes along. And I think there's ways that we can be a bit more flexible around that and take an approach. And look, pleasingly, and because I don't want this to sound like just another industry gripe, I do think that there's a lot of really good people in a lot of really key places in the government at the moment that are really trying to achieve that. And I think if industry and the government can really see eye to eye on that and develop those partnerships early rather than a contractual relationship, then that'll really help us get to that end result of making sure that the Canadian forces have what they need, not just from a capability and a, you know, weapons, sensors, vehicles, trucks, you know, aircraft, ships type perspective, but from an infrastructure perspective as well, because, you know, we need to make sure that we drag other parts of the Canadian industry into this as well that will help out, you know, the Canadian troops have a really, you know, solid base from which to go to work and do a really great job. Because to my point from earlier in the podcast, that soft side of it, of making sure that they're happy, their families are happy, they've got good places to live, they've got good places to work and to stay, then, you know, that gets them wanting to go to work every day and face the, you know, the hardships that they face and the times away that they have to endure as well. Because I've been there, I've done that. And, you know, it is important. And that's why people leave, because their home life isn't what they need it to be. So to me, the infrastructure is just as important as the platforms and systems that they're using. And I think as an industry and as a government, we've got a role to play in making sure that all of that happens and happens faster.
Finally, how can Canada build capability faster, which you've touched on, while keeping more value in IP at home? And how does this approach strengthen our Arctic readiness and turn Canadian mission expertise into an exportable capability for our allies?
Yeah, good question. There's obviously a lot in that, but I think when we talk about what we were looking at before about growing Canadian sovereignty and bringing capabilities here that Canadian companies own and using the ITB policy to make sure that international companies who win contracts in Canada bring not only work to Canada to meet the ITB policy, but bring IP to Canada that Canada can then use for its own good and use with other Canadian, you know, if the government owns the IP or certainly has the right to use that IP, then that builds on the sovereignty of the capabilities that Canada can then, you know, update and modify as technology changes. You know, the ability to do that means that we can do more here in Canada, and the aerospace industry can do more with the IP that the government is giving them access to because they've either purchased it or they have invested some money through maybe the ITB policy or through maybe, you know, programs like IDEAS and that sort of thing into having, you know, sovereign IP capabilities here, which then enables to build on that, to build newer technologies that are purely Canadian. And it's those sorts of capabilities which I see as being the ones that are most likely to provide successful exports for the Canadian defence industry in the future. But for me, that you've almost got to take that to a separate level because, you know, companies around the world, you know, like your Saabs and your Lockheeds and your Boeings and your Northrops and, you know, your Hanwhas, you know, for example, they've already spent an awful lot of money developing this IP in their products over a long, long period of time. So quite rightly, they don't just want to give it away as part of it. that's where I think you elevate it to a different level. So for bigger programs like fighter jets and submarines and, you know, new aircraft, you know, across a range of things and land vehicles and the like, where they're worth a lot of money, you know, it's a real government-to-government partnership that needs to happen on top of that, because that can really help industry and D&D and PSPC and ICED get an understanding of what the government, you know, where the government's providing that strategic direction from. And I think that there's an opportunity to look at other allied partners around what that IP looks like and how maybe Canada says, okay, we're not going to develop that capability. We're going to get all of that from this country, but there's a quid pro quo. That country is now going to not develop that another capability in their country, and they're going to get it all from Canada. And I think that would provide more guidance. It would help industry have, you know, better boundaries as to where to spend their innovation funds and where to put their investments from an R&D perspective, and then particularly in Canada. Because then companies that are international companies might go, you know what, we're going to develop that capability in the Canadian arm of our company rather than do it in the US or in Europe or in Australia, because that's a strategic capability for Canada. So it's getting there. You know, I mean, I think the Prime Minister's been very clear. He's been, you know, he's obviously signing up to SAFE in Europe, showing a clear allegiance to wanting to do more work with European countries and European companies. I think the announcement at CANSEC, you know, 2 days ago around the airborne early warning capability, and Canada working closely with Sweden to do that, Saab already has a relationship with Bombardier to do that, is a really clear indication of that. And now we've got to take that and then expand it to other Canadian companies like PAL, who I think can have a role in programs, you know, like that and other programs well into the future. And then through the natural development of those programs and those capabilities and the use of IP that is then afforded to the Canadian government, you start developing new capabilities into the future, which enable Canadian industry to export to other countries, hopefully countries that we already have a country-to-country and a government-to-government relationship with. And so it just keeps building on each other, you know, on itself, basically, over time. And, you know, it's quid pro quo, though. I mean, we as an industry have to be willing to give some things up and say, okay, we're not going to develop that technology. It's going to come from somewhere else. We might not like it when it gets denounced, but we appreciate it, and we at least understand it. And look, in the long run, it might save companies millions of dollars because they don't bid on programs that they're never going to be able to win, or they don't develop a technology that's never going to be adopted by the Canadian Armed Forces. And I think we've seen a bit too much of that over time, you know, particularly for the smaller companies, the SMEs, who do the ideas programs and get funded and then have a great product that's ticked all the boxes, but there's no program to sell that product to. And that's where they've looked offshore, and maybe we've lost IP by doing that. So let's come up with ways to help keep IP. And look, a really good example that I'll give you, and I was on the, you know, the wrong side of this one, but the Navy announcing really early that they've down-selected to Hanwha and TKMS in the submarine program. I didn't like the decision. I hated it at the time, but it was really logical and made a lot of sense from a Navy perspective and how they wanted to get this program integrated. And I've had this discussion with Admiral Topshe and actually congratulated him. I said, even though it hurts and it didn't work out for me and the company that I was working for at the time, it was the right decision to down select that early in the piece, because it gets things moving and it gets now the industry understanding the Canadian industry, that is, who they need to talk to, what capabilities, you know, and technology they have to offer, and, you know, the best way to get that in as part of the program, because that's going to be a program, let's face it, that'll be around for 40 years. And if industry wants a piece of it, they've now got only two providers that they need to talk to help progress what they might want to do in the future. And, I think the Navy's really on the right track, and it's a really good program that we can, you know, for these bigger programs in the future, use as a blueprint for how best to execute. You know, we're learning all the time, but to me, that's a really good example of what is the art of the possible from an industry and a government perspective.
Okay, well, Simon, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much, and James, and really appreciate the opportunity.
You've been listening to the latest in the Canadian Defence Focus series. It is produced by Canadian Defence Review, Canada's leading defence magazine. I've been speaking with Simon Carroll, the new president of PAL Aerospace. To hear more Canadian Defence Focus podcasts, go to CanadianDefenseReview.com or find us on iTunes and YouTube under Canadian Defence Focus. I'm James Careless. Thank you for listening to Canadian Defence Focus. Talk to you again next time.
Tune in next time for another Canadian Defence Focus podcast from CDR Radio.